Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, May 7th, 2026. I almost said April, but it's May already, May 7th, 2026. I'm Jean, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list only includes one name. Robert J. Lights, 73, of Scottsdale. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the person listed in today's obituaries. And now we're going to turn to the business section of the paper. Looks like there's three articles on that one. The first one is entitled Meta Sued for Copyright Infringement. This was written by Blake Britton for the Reuters News Group. Publishers Elsevier, Cengage, Hachette, Macmillan, and McGraw-Hill sued Meta Platforms in Manhattan federal court on May 5th, alleging that the tech giant misused their books and journal articles to train its artificial intelligence model called Llama. The publishers, as well as the author Scott Turow, alleged in the proposed class action complaint that Meta pirated millions of their works and used them without permission to train its large language models to respond to human prompts. A Meta spokesperson responded in a statement on May 5th and said, quote, AI is powering transformative innovations, productivity, and creativity for individuals and companies, and courts have rightly found that training AI on copyrighted material can qualify as fair use. We will fight this lawsuit aggressively, unquote. The publishers allege that Meta pirated works ranging from textbooks to scientific articles, to novels, which included The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin and The Wild Robot by Peter Brown for its AI training. They asked the court for permission to represent a larger class of copyright owners and an unspecified amount of monetary damages. Maria Palante, president of the Association of American Publishers, said in a statement, quote, Meta's mass-scale infringement is not public progress, and AI will never be properly realized if tech companies prioritize pirate sites over scholarship and imagination, unquote. So the lawsuit opens a new front in the ongoing battle between creators and tech companies over AI training, in which dozens of authors and news outlets and visual artists and other plaintiffs have sued companies, including Meta and OpenAI and Anthropic, for infringement. Now, the first two judges to consider the matter issued diverging rulings last year. Amazon and Google-backed Anthropic was the first major AI company to settle one of the cases. They agreed last year to pay a group of authors $1.5 billion to resolve a class action lawsuit that could have cost the company billions more in damages for alleged piracy. And that's the article, Meta Sued for Copyright Infringement. Our second article mentions something similar. Anthropic pushes into finance industry. This is by Jeffrey Dastan and Kenneth Lee for the Reuters News Group out of New York. Artificial intelligence lab Anthropic is diving deeper into the financial services industry, releasing tools on May 5th that can speed up myriad tasks for banks and insurers, while CEO Dario Amodei predicted further software disruption. Pegged to a New York event hosted by Anthropic, the startup launched 10 financially focused agents. Those are AI programs that work with little human intervention. These include agents that build pitch books, audit statements or draft credit menus, according to Anthropic. The company also announced new data sources that its Claude AI can access to do financial work. Hardly a year into unveiling ambitions to tailor AI for finance, Anthropic has rapidly expanded its business, with adoption by Goldman Sachs and Visa and Citi and AIG and other companies. Some 40% of Anthropic's top 50 customers are financial institutions, and the industry represents its second largest by enterprise revenue after technology clients. Speaking from the stage at the PACT event, Amodai said Anthropic's revenue in the first quarter had grown 80 times on an annualized basis. A later slide presentation also stated, quote, "Coding has changed forever. Finance is next," unquote. That was referring to the rise of AI-powered programming, a domain that is led by Anthropic. Already, for instance, banks have been scrambling to access Anthropic's Claude Mythos model to shore up their cybersecurity. Amodai said Mythos had probably found tens of thousands of vulnerabilities across industries so far, and that there should be legislation or rules on the release of powerful AI models. Amodai appeared on stage in a joint interview with Jamie Dimon, who is the chief executive of J.P. Morgan Chase. Asked about AI's impact on jobs, Dimon said that technology would improve lives and that its negative impacts were also, quote, "a legitimate concern," unquote. The Anthropic CEO had a stark forecast for software disruption. For months, Anthropic's drive to automate enterprise work has hammered an array of software as a service stock due to anticipation that the AI provider could supplant their business. The San Francisco-based startup has said that it wants to improve outcomes for customers rather than replace them. Amodai said at the event that AI is making software development cheaper and will cause the industry to grow overall. However, he did say this, quote, "I don't know what will happen to the group of today's SaaS incumbents," unquote. The companies that address AI head-on can do better than ever, while others may, quote, "lose market value, go bankrupt, or completely go bust," unquote, he said. In an earlier Reuters interview, Nicholas Lin, who leads Anthropic's financial services product work, said an increasingly capable Claude would develop vertical specific intelligence, even as the startup's AI is widely applicable across industries. And that was the article, Anthropic Pushes into Finance Industry. The third article from the business section of the paper, CEO says Ford considering more global partnerships. This was written by Jamie L. LaRue from Detroit. Ford Motor Company CEO Jim Farley addressed a number of topics during a far-reaching conversation with Wall Street analysts in an hour-long call on April 29th, following Ford's first quarter earnings results. Among the highlights, Farley said the company is considering more global partnerships with other automakers, including Chinese, and are carefully monitoring the Iran war for impact on its business and employees near the region, and it is in talks with the U.S. government on how it can help in the war effort. Ford reported its first quarter revenue rose 6% to $43.3 billion. That's compared with $40.7 billion in the first quarter a year ago, despite lower new vehicle sales in the United States. It reported that its adjusted earnings before interest and taxes was $3.5 billion compared with $1 billion a year ago. Its net income for the quarter was $2.5 billion compared with $471 million in the year-ago quarter. The rosy results, along with Ford leaders believing that the underlying business has the momentum to carry the company through the second half of the year, delivering gains, prompted the Dearborn, Michigan automaker to boost its estimated 2026 adjusted pre-tax profits by $500 million. They think now it's going to be $10.5 billion instead of $8.5 billion. In mid-April, it was widely reported, including by the Detroit Free Press, that senior defense officials in the Trump administration are seeking help from Ford and General Motors to increase the nation's supply of military equipment. So when asked about the status of it, Farley said Ford has always answered the call to duty to support the country, noting its work to make life-saving ventilators during the COVID-19 pandemic and making military equipment during World War I and World War II. He said, quote, "We are very successful with our government sales and business and Ford Pro, and so we have very close relationships through the vehicle side. What I'd be able to say at this point is we are in early discussions with the U.S. government on some defense-related projects. We're not going to go into details of those today," unquote. In addition to possibly helping with the government with munitions, Farley said that Ford would help with onshoring critical minerals and many other supply chain vulnerabilities that we have in our country. "I think you should expect Ford to play an outsized role in manufacturer-grade semiconductors, critical minerals like batteries, and rare earth, and our supply chain is heavily engaged, not only with our government, but new companies that are starting to emerge in our country to onshore some of this capability. Perhaps in the short term, that's the biggest role that Ford can help in playing in helping our country," unquote. Farley said that Ford is dedicated to a thriving U.S. auto industry and safeguarding the country's industrial base for both economic vitality and national security. He said, quote, "When we see China and Japan and South Korea, they've really prioritized their domestic auto industry and manufacturing for these same reasons that I mentioned. We leverage global partnerships and even IT sharing, including with the Chinese automakers, to grow our business around the world," unquote. But Farley said, Ford seeks a level playing field in the United States and to protect national security. Therefore, quote, "How I would think about it is Ford continues to be a global company. We want to have the rights to win around the globe. We need IT and partnerships outside the U.S. to do that, and when it comes to the U.S. industry itself, we are extremely protective, as we should be, like China, South Korea, and Japan are," unquote. He declined to provide any specific policies of Ford's strategy beyond that comment. Farley said Ford will, quote, "remain resilient in the face of global uncertainty regarding the conflict in the Middle East. Of course, our priority is our team and the safety of them," unquote. As the Detroit Free Press reported last March, the Detroit automakers have minimal exposure in that part of the world. Ford's closest factories are in Turkey. Farley said that Ford is monitoring the war and working to minimize risk, quote, "and find opportunities in much the same way we have navigated the pandemic, the semiconductor shortage, tariff headwinds, and others. We have the muscle memory to find cost offsets, adjust our product mix quickly, interactively manage our supply chain in times of stress and crisis. My main message today is this: Ford is a fundamentally stronger, more modern company. We have a foundation built on industrial fitness," unquote. Farley said by the end of the decade, 90% of Ford's global nameplates will offer electrified powertrains, including advanced hybrids, extended-range electric vehicles, and full EVs. He said, quote, "Our financial health is driven by a leaner, more effective industrial system. We are on track to deliver another over $1 billion in material and warranty cost improvements this year, and we will never stop. Our focus on quality is paying off." J.D. Power recently ranked Ford number 4 in the 2026 U.S. Customer Service Index, which is our best performance in 30 years, unquote. And that was the article, CEO Says Ford Considering More Global Partnerships. And those are the three articles from the business section of the paper. At coming up on 16 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on over to the sports section. Well, on the front page of the sports section, there is a picture of a guy. Looks like he might be a football player working out. Oh, yeah, underneath the picture it says, Brophy College Prep Lineman, UN Taufetti Jr., works out during spring practice on May 4th at the Brophy Prep Sports Campus in Phoenix. Well, he looks intense. But right below the picture is the title of the article, It Looks Like I Made the Right Choice. This was written by Richard Obert for the Arizona Republic. Phoenix Brophy Prep's first 2 weeks of spring football have attracted major college coaches who have liked what they've seen, especially from its freshmen. Penn State offered receiver and defensive back Bishop Allen and offensive guard UN Taufetti Jr., and offensive lineman Colin Etule, all part of Brophy's loaded 2029 class. It offered them on the same day. Taufetti, in particular, has a compelling story. He is a four-time Arizona Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu champion and two-time World Junior League champ. Homeschooled until he got to Brophy, he was steered to the game by his parents last summer, who told him he had to play football. He said, quote, "They said, if you want to go to Brophy, you need to play football. Well, it looks like I made the right choice," unquote. His father, who shares the same first name, is from Samoa and played defensive tackle at North Dakota State in the late 2000s. Taufetti Jr. wasn't quite sure about playing football. His dream had always been to compete in judo in the Olympics, and it still is. He said, "At first, I was scared of the physical contact, but now I really enjoy it." He's been a quick learner under offensive line coach Mark Martinez, who took him under his wing last summer. Looking more like an upperclassman, he started every varsity game in his first year ever playing organized football as a freshman last season. During the first week of spring football, he got offered by Michigan. A week before spring football began, he picked up a Mississippi State offer. And now, he's 6'4", 306 pounds, he has got Penn State wanting him. He said, "I can see myself doing this in college," unquote. UN Taufetti Sr. said his son found his first love of sports in martial arts, and he still competes when he can. But football has taken up a lot of his time now. He was homeschooled between his 6th and 8th grade years. The plan was for that to change once he reached the high school level. UN Taufetti Jr. said about the homeschooling, quote, "It got really lonely. I'd sit with my siblings and my friends at jiu-jitsu. I really wanted to come back to school. They said I could come back to school my freshman year," unquote. He started jiu-jitsu when he was 9. 2 years later, he began competing. He works with adults when he trains. He is 15 now. Last football season, he felt intimidated at first, going up against the best and biggest defensive lines in the state, like Chandler Powers, Basha, and Hamilton. He said, quote, "My coaches and my teammates got my back, so they helped me through the season. At times, I was feeling down, but they always built me back up. They would say, 'Don't quit. It was also quite the transition from being homeschooled to taking rigorous courses at Brophy, but I made mostly A grades this school year. His mother, Alexandria, said he's very smart. Oh, and incidentally, Alexandria is a Phoenix Xavier Prep graduate. She went on and said, even with Rubik's Cube and chess and algorithms, things like that, he learns it in a short time frame. It keeps his mind occupied. I think everybody just sees this big guy, but when he puts his mind to something, he goes full bore with it and will work hours on his craft, whether it's academically or the sport, unquote. His dad said that he has had his son do some football drills in the backyard at times, but never got him into organized ball until last summer. He said it took his son 3 months to learn football before getting to Brophy. Dad says, quote, he would say, now it makes sense. He's just a hard-working kid. He would never stop working. Every day he'd say, Dad, let's go. Mom, let's go. He was too big to compete in wrestling, Ewan Sr. said. He likes judo because of the takedowns, unquote. Well, he won't stop competing in martial arts, but now he's got something else to strive for and a likely college scholarship down the road playing football. He said, jiu-jitsu taught me resilience and discipline. You have to stay disciplined. You have to keep training. Resilience, every time you lose a match, you get back up. In jiu-jitsu, you say, either you win or you learn. And that's the article, It Looks Like I Made the Right Choice. Another article on the sports page, front page. Rodriguez, Silence Pirates, Bats Wake Up in Rout. This was written by Nick Pecoro and Jose M. Romero for the Arizona Republic. Diamondbacks left-hander Eduardo Rodriguez could sense a change might be coming. He knew his pitch count was climbing. He saw action in the bullpen. He figured manager Torey Lovullo might be ready to move. So, after he recorded the second out of the seventh inning on Tuesday night, May 5th, Rodriguez turned toward the dugout and locked eyes with Lovullo. No words were spoken. But with some head nods and a little pointing, a deal was reached. Rodriguez would get one last batter. He made it count. Lovullo later said, quote, he told me by his actions to sit down. I gladly did that. He showed me, unquote. Rodriguez struck out Joey Bart on his 103rd and final pitch to complete 7 scoreless innings of 2-hit ball in a game the Diamondbacks went on to win 9-0 over the Pittsburgh Pirates. It was a much-needed pitching performance to lead the way to a much-needed victory, one that stopped a 4-game skid and pulled the Diamondbacks' record back to the 500 mark at 17 wins and 17 losses. Earlier in the day, Lovullo sat at the podium in the Chase Field interview room and reluctantly acknowledged a meeting he called with his starting pitchers. In Chicago, a few days earlier, Lovullo gathered them in his office and challenged them to be better. More specifically, to find the strike zone more often, to force opposing batters to hit their way onto base. And Rodriguez more or less did that. He was certainly effective. The Pirates had only 3 men advance so far as second base, even if he did issue 3 walks. Rodriguez struck out 7, blending his 5-pitch mix effectively against the Pirates' heavily right-handed lineup. Rodriguez said, quote, it was one of those when everything was working and you just go out there and throw. Those are the days we're all hoping to have as a starting pitcher, and I had it today, unquote. Lovullo said, quote, I talked to these starting pitchers and challenged them to go out there and do exactly what he did. I think they all want to put it in my face a little bit. Check. He did it. Next up, well, we'll see what happens tomorrow. Now, Rodriguez mostly cruised through his first 6 innings, but with a runner on second base in the 7th inning, he had just struck out Jake Mangum for the second out of the inning, when he managed to convince Lovullo to give him a chance to finish the inning. Rodriguez said, "I was just looking into the dugout until he saw me, and I told him to give me one more." Only, he said, he didn't say the words out loud, and neither did Lovullo. Rodriguez said, "No, I just looked in, and he looked at me. I feel like we just went with our head gestures, and I went like, no, and he just pointed to the hitter and said, you want this guy? And I said, yeah, and we ended up doing the job." Rodriguez downplayed the interaction, noting that he is the type of pitcher to never want to exit a game. In fact, it was only 6 days ago that he tried to talk Lovullo into leaving him in a game in Milwaukee in hopes of completing the fifth inning. Lovullo didn't go for it, but this time he did. "I like that," Lovullo said. "I like challenges. I challenged him, he challenged me back to sit down and wait, and he struck out his last hitter. I like that kind of stuff. It fires me up. I trust these players. Sometimes I trust them too much. But I believe in the athlete being able to go out there and execute. My gut instinct tells me when it's time. I felt like he had a tiny little bit more gas in the tank," unquote. Offensively, the Diamondbacks got contributions up and down their lineup. And they also got help from a Pirates pitching staff that walked seven and hit two more, and from a Pirates defense that did not play clean defensively. The Diamondbacks, when they were leading 2-0, blew it open in the sixth inning, scoring five times, thanks in part to two hit batters and a walk. In that inning, Gabriel Moreno and Geraldo Perdomo each hit doubles down the right field line to pad the lead. It had added up to that kind of game the Diamondbacks rarely play, the blowout, low-pressure victory. Lovullo said, "I think it's good for all of our psyche and our blood pressure and all those things that go with good health. You can kind of turn off the valve a little bit there in the late innings. I think it's a reminder of the type of team we can be when we do the things we're supposed to do," unquote. The struggles of the Diamondbacks' rotation prompted manager Torey Lovullo to hold a meeting with his five starters last weekend in Chicago. Lovullo said, "I let them know what was on my mind." He described it as a meeting that featured most of the dialogue going in one direction. The thrust of the message he wanted to send, he said, was to cut down on the number of walks that the group had been issuing. Lovullo said, quote, "Really, the main theme was putting the ball on the plate. Eliminate the walks. We talk about not compounding things by eliminating a free pass and making them hit their way on," unquote. Well, over the past 12 games, entering Tuesday, May 5th, the Diamondback starters have logged a 10-10 ERA while averaging a shade over 4 innings per start. Each of the five starters has had at least one clunker during that stretch, with right-hander Merrill Kelly turning in three of them. Lovullo said, "We've got to be better. We've challenged them. We told them they're the right group. They are experienced. They know exactly what they got to get to, and in my opinion, it's a matter of time until they turn it around," unquote. Now, outfielder Jordan Lawler, who's been out since breaking his wrist on April 2nd, is about 2 weeks away from being able to start swinging the bat. That means Lawler is pointing toward a potential return roughly in early June, which is when he is eligible to be reinstated from the 60-day injured list. In other Diamondbacks injury updates, Lovullo said first baseman Pavin Smith could begin taking dry swings as soon as next week. Smith has been out since the first week of the season with an elbow issue that required surgery. First baseman Carlos Santana, out with an adductor strain in his right leg, has played two games on a rehab assignment with AAA Reno. Another first baseman, Tyler Locklear, who has been out since needing surgeries on both his elbow and shoulder last year, has been getting at-bats in the Complex League and will shift to Reno later this week. In a pair of roster moves, the Diamondbacks announced that both catcher Aramis Garcia and infielder Jesus Valdez had cleared waivers and were outrighted to AAA Reno. So with their removals, the Diamondbacks' 40-man roster is now at 38. And that was the article, Rodriguez Silences Pirates. Bats Wake Up En Route. Next, our third article from the front page of the sports section is all about college men's basketball. ASU coach Bennett, contract unsigned. Intro rescheduled. Written by Jason Wolf for the Arizona Republic. More than a month after his introductory press conference in March was indefinitely postponed because of a health issue, the new Arizona State men's basketball coach, Randy Bennett, has yet to sign a contract with the school. But the delay is not unusual. Martin Greenberg, an attorney and professor who founded the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University, said that after a non-binding memorandum of understanding or term sheet is in place, a contract is normally signed, quote, within 60 to 90 days and at most 6 months, unquote. Greenberg said delays in signing are usually tied to legalese about exit clauses, but that Bennett's health could also be an issue, quote, if he's not able to perform the services he's contracted for. He doesn't want to be in breach of that contract from the start, unquote. But, then he said, I don't think it's anything to be concerned of, unquote. Bennett's introductory news conference is planned for Thursday morning, May 7th at 8:30 a.m. The Mesa native will turn 64 in June. He coached at St. Mary's in Moraga, California for 25 years before agreeing to coach the Sun Devils, and he was hired back on March 23rd. Bennett's contract with Arizona State is a 5-year deal valued at $18.5 million in guaranteed compensation, running through March 31, 2031, according to details released by the school. He begins with a base salary of $3.5 million for the 26-27 season, with a $100,000 annual raise. He will also receive two $750,000 retention bonuses if he remains employed through the 28-29 and the 2030-31 seasons. The contract also grants incentives for athletic and academic performance, including $50,000 bonuses for a Big 12 tournament title and an NCAA tournament appearance, $100,000 for a conference regular season title, and $600,000 for winning the national championship. Another $2.3 million is allocated for assistant coaches and support staff. Bennett has hired at least four key assistants who have experience with him at St. Mary's, including Joe Rahan, David Patrick, Rick Croy, and E.J. Rowland. If Bennett leaves for another position before the contract expires, he is subject to a buyout, starting at $8 million if he were to leave before March 31, 2027, and decreasing to $5 million, $3 million, $2 million, and then nothing each year thereafter. The Arizona Board of Regents approved the terms of Bennett's deal with ASU on April 16th, along with the terms of a contract extension for University of Arizona men's basketball coach Tommy Lloyd, which Lloyd signed. Now, ASU hired Bennett to replace Bobby Hurley, whose contract was allowed to expire after 11 seasons. 2 years ago, in March 2024, Hurley had still not signed a contract extension announced by ASU a year earlier, which was an extraordinarily unusual delay. That's what the Republic reported at that time. And then he signed the contract a week later. Bennett released a statement in March after his introductory press conference was postponed. He said, "Last week when I arrived in Arizona, a health situation surfaced that I'm working through right now. I'm in good hands. We feel good about the plan. And I'm incredibly appreciative of the care that I have received from the team at Mayo Clinic. Everything is under control, and I will be back at full strength very soon." And that was the article, ASU Coach Bennett, contract unsigned, intro rescheduled. And the fourth article from the front page of the sports section. Top seeds fall in high school baseball playoffs. An article written also by Richard Obert for the Arizona Republic. the number one seed, Queen Creek, and the number two seed, Queen Creek Castile, both lost their second round games of the 6A State Baseball Tournament on Tuesday, May 5th at Tempe Diablo Stadium. Queen Creek fell to number 9th ranked Mesa Red Mountain by a score of 7-5, and Castile lost to number 10th Phoenix Sandra Day O'Connor by a score of 3-0, both of them falling into the loser's bracket for the double elimination tournament. And now the top seeds will find out how strong their pitching depth is, trying to dig their way back into the tournament. They will have to win 3 elimination games over 6 days just to get to the semifinals. Red Mountain and O'Connor don't play again until May 9th. If they both win those games, they would advance to the May 15th semifinals. Castile coach Matt Denny said, quote, "This doesn't change the fact that we can still get it done with it being double elimination. I think we're the best team in the state, and we will continue to pound that until it stops," unquote. O'Connor's Tommy Pascanu, a left-hander, showed why he was voted the pitcher of the year, with 6 1/3 innings of shutout ball in the 3-0 win over Castile. He gave up just 2 hits in the first 2 innings before giving up a single to Ryan Barker in the 6th inning. Barker never advanced past first base. In the 7th inning, Pascanu walked Ryan Harwood on 4 pitches and then gave up a ball on the first pitch to the next batter before O'Connor coach Jeff Bumgardner made a mound visit to settle his ace down. He got Blake Gonzalez to fly out before giving way to Gio Boncora Montoya, who got the final 2 batters out to save the shutout. Baumgartner said, quote, "They were the number 2 seed. We didn't have a chance. They're so good. But we just came out and played relaxed," unquote. O'Connor had to win a play-in game just to get to the 6A tournament. They defeated Mesa Mountain View in the first round. Then Pascanu was assigned the Castile game. Baumgartner said, quote, "He was just voted the pitcher of the year for the state of Arizona, and I wanted him to have a chance to show them," unquote. All the run support that Pascanu needed came in the top of the first inning. That's when Clayton Sheets' hardliner off the first baseman rolled into right field to score 2 runs. Sheets singled again in the top of the 7th inning and scored on Jalen Jimenez's single. Pascanu, who is committed to Arizona, said, quote, "Putting 2 up in the first, none of the guys looked back. We just ran with it," unquote. The spacious Diablo ballpark helped. Pascanu got Castile to fly out 12 times. O'Connor, who is 24-8, it next plays in the 3rd round of the winner's bracket against number 3 Chandler Hamilton on May 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Diablo Stadium. Hamilton, the number 3 seed, beat Umakofa 4-1. Red Mountain advances in the winner's bracket against the defending state champion and the number 4 ranked Tempe Corona del Sol on May 9th at 4 p.m. at Diablo Stadium. Red Mountain broke a 5-5 tie with 2 runs in the top of the 6th inning. Jacob Gabel drove in the go-ahead run with a single. He later scored on a wild pitch. Gabel pitched the 7th for the win, giving up 1 hit. So, in an elimination game on May 5th, Dylan Lopez pitched a no-hitter in Chandler's 2-0 win over Peoria Liberty. He struck out 6 and he walked none. It wasn't a perfect game because 2 runners reached on errors. Chandler will face Castile in another elimination game on Thursday, May 7th at 4 p.m. at Castile High. Queen Creek will face number 12th Millennium on Thursday, May 7th at 4 p.m. in an elimination game at Queen Creek High. The Tigers defeated Apollo 13-4 on May 5th. And that was Richard Obert's article, Top Seeds Fall in High School Baseball Playoffs. And at 40 minutes past the hour, we have finished with the front page of the sports section. We ought to turn the pages and see if there's anything interesting inside the sports section. Well, here's a little NASCAR news for you kart racing fans. Spurlock, ready to shock NASCAR. Written by Mitchell Northam for the USA Today. It wasn't that long ago that Destiny Spurlock was driving tractor trailers. The 34-year-old Virginia native has a commercial driver's license and would find work hauling all kinds of things with an 18-wheeler, from trash to crushed cars to construction materials. It was one of a few odd jobs that she had. Being a flight attendant was another, and helped fund her pursuit of a career in professional motorsports. Spurlock has won drag races with motorcycles and competed in Formula 4. But ever since she was a kid growing up on a stone's throw away from the Richmond Raceway, NASCAR has been her ultimate goal. She was sitting on the back of the motorcycles her parents drove as early as the age of 3, riding on the lawnmower in her grandfather's lap, and cheering for Dale Earnhardt on race days. Spurlock told the USA Today Sports recently, quote, "Every Sunday, NASCAR was going to be on the TV. My grandfather would open the door because we were 2 miles from Richmond Raceway, and it was something about being able to hear them outside when they were there and watching it on TV. It just really awakened something in me. So I've always been a NASCAR girly. Ever since I was that little girl watching it, I just knew I liked to go fast. And then as I grew up, I'm like, okay, how am I going to do this?" Unquote. Well, Spurlock is getting her opportunity to make her mark in NASCAR, and she will make history when she does. On Friday, May 8th, at Watkins Glen, Spurlock will become the first black woman to race in one of NASCAR's top 3 touring competitions when she pilots the number 69 Foxteca Toyota for MBM Motorsports and Garage 66 in the Craftsman Truck Series. Spurlock will pull double duty that day at the Glen, as she's also competing in the ARCA Menards Series General Tire 100. The ARCA race is first, followed by the truck race a few hours later. This will be the 4th ARCA race that Spurlock has driven in this season, and she has finished inside the top 12 in each of her 3 previous entries at Hickory, Rockingham, and Kansas. Spurlock said, quote, "I'm so excited about Watkins Glen because with my Formula 4 experience, I'm getting back on a road course. I've never raced there, but I have already been in the simulation rig. It's very similar to Formula 4 road courses. Of course, the only difference is I'm not paddle shifting now. I'm actually shifting. But I did that for 9 years in a tractor trailer, so I'm good." Unquote. ARCA, A-R-C-A, is sort of like NASCAR's minor leagues and one of the first major steps along the ladder to getting to the top of the sport, where the Cup Series resides. Spurlock made her ARCA debut at Hickory Motor Speedway in North Carolina on March 28th and finished 7th, quickly impressing the field and showing other drivers this wasn't a stunt, she was serious. Spurlock continued to gain respect when she finished 12th at Rockingham on April 4th. She turned heads and got fans talking on April 18th when she pulled off an incredible save after getting pushed down the track by eventual winner Gio Ruggiero. After Ruggiero plowed into the left side of her bumper and turned her nose toward the infield, Spurlock was able to keep the car from spinning or entering the grass, regaining her control on the apron. Her number 6 Ford Mustang would go on to finish 10th, but the save garnered Spurlock some admiration from other drivers in the garage. She said, quote, "Bobby Earnhardt came up to me and was like, 'Girl, I saw that scene. You definitely made a believer out of me. Don't stop.' And that was the highlight of Kansas for me, other drivers coming up and embracing me." Unquote. Because of Spurlock's strong debut in the ARCA, she's the first black woman to drive in that series. She plans to race as much as she can this season at that level. In ARCA's East Series standings, she is 6th in points. This year for Spurlock is all about learning and improving. In the perfect world, She is aiming to make her debut in the Cup Series within the next 3 years, where she would be, of course, pursuing more history. But she's no stranger to being the first or only woman to do something. At the Highland Springs High School, she was the only girl on her tackle football team, where she played defensive back. She said, quote, "That was the beginning of me doing something in a male-dominated field, and then it just kept going. Tractor trailers, racing motorcycles, NASCAR. To me, it's normal because that's all I know. It doesn't faze me at all," unquote. Spurlock has been drag racing motorcycles for a long time, beginning at the age of 16, and pulled off a lot of firsts in that sport as well. In 2024, she made history as the first woman to win the DME Racing Real Street class in the XDA Motorcycle Drag Racing Series with a run at 178 miles per hour. A year later, she debuted in NHRA Pro Stock Motorcycle. Not only has a black woman never raced in NASCAR, but no woman has ever won a race in the Truck Series, the second-tier O'Reilly Auto Parts Series, or at the Cup level. And still, Spurlock doesn't feel much pressure as she breaks down barriers in stock car racing. She said, "I've broken a lot of records before. I've been the first in a lot of things, so that was never any pressure on me. This is my passion. This is what I love. I don't race for me. Yes, I love racing, but I do this for the other generation that's coming up. Because my story is, everybody kept everything. Nobody told me what I needed to do to get to NASCAR. I literally had to go through the mud to figure it out," unquote. Now, Foxteca, which bills itself as an experimental media and events company based in Detroit, has sponsored Spurlock all season and is producing a docuseries called Driven by Destiny, D-Y-S-T-A-N-Y, which is Spurlock's first name. The company, co-founded by Chris Harris and Kelly Crawford, has funded Spurlock's dream and historic pursuit and helped her unlock the gates that kept her out of the sport for so long. Quote, "I've had so many doors shut in my face. I've had so many people overpromise and underdeliver. You have to have the money, be born into it, or you just have to have some miraculous connection with someone that can get you there. And once I realized I didn't have any of those, that's when I just focused on drag racing motorcycles, because I could afford to do it myself." That's when Foxteca came in. They called me and were like, "Put your 2 weeks in. Find a house in North Carolina," unquote. Well, Spurlock left 18-wheelers behind and is now focused on stock car racing. With her CDL, or commercial driver's license, if she does make it all the way to the Cup Series, she'll be able to drive her own hauler into the infield. And the thought of that image makes her smile. She said, "I'm definitely pulling up to the track in it one time, and that's it." And that was the article, Spurlock Ready to Shock NASCAR. At 48 minutes past the hour, time for us to move on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. If you were born between March 21st and April 19th, that's the sign of Aries. You are the best at what you do, and you know it. If only you could convince others to share your confidence. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th birth dates, are you moving in the shadows? As the Moon and Mars clash, belief in your integrity is blinding you to danger. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, that was a little harsh. As the Moon clashes with Mars, remember this, hurt people hurt people. For Cancer, birthdays from June 22nd through July 22nd. Your goal is a good one, but how you accomplish it counts. Avoid making an ally into an enemy today. For Leos, birthdates from July 23rd through August 22nd. Are you taking an interest or endeavor further? Well, self-improvement is your aim as the Moon and Mars clash, but know your limits. For you fellow Virgos out there, birthdates from August 23rd through September 22nd, check in with your intuition. Is this romantic infatuation healthy, or Has it run its course? For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates, why are they making this difficult? A loved one is disagreeable today, but so are you. Mind your temper. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, are you clashing with a co-worker? As the moon squares off with Mars, they are deviating from the plan and ignoring your instructions. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, you want what you want, but do you need it? A little self-restraint goes a long way today. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, are you angry at a friend? Are you stressed over office drama? Well, funnel that energy into home improvements while the Moon and Mars clash. For Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th birth dates, are you putting up a strong front? As the Moon and Mars square off, fear gets you into a fight. And finally, for Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th, are you trying to resolve tensions on the team? Well, throwing money at a problem is not the fix you think it is. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. First letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I'm a 60-year-old man. I have a close female friend who is 20 years younger. We see each other just about every day and call each other to talk about our day. We have supper together just about every night. The only thing we don't have is a romance. I have strong feelings for her and want to tell her how I feel, but I'm worried that if I do, it will ruin our friendship. Do you have any advice for me? Signed, Clueless in Alabama. Dear Clueless, what's going on is unsatisfying for you. This younger woman knows you care about her and have much in common. She may not be aware that you have more in mind. If you don't speak up, your relationship with her stands no chance of moving to a higher level. If you do, and she tells you the chemistry isn't mutual, you will then be free to find a woman who reciprocates. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I recently retired after a 25-year career in law enforcement. My mother, whom my family and I see a lot of and have gone on vacation with in the past, did not get me a congratulatory card. I was hurt by it because she's usually more thoughtful than that. Mom also lectured me about going on vacation after my retirement, saying it was selfish. I had planned to go with my wife and daughters, but they couldn't go. I ended up feeling guilty and stayed somewhere close for 2 days. What are your thoughts on this? I try not to let it bother me, but it was hurtful. Signed, Next Chapter in New Jersey. Then Abby responds, Dear Next Chapter, I see nothing selfish about taking some time for yourself after your retirement. You were certainly entitled to it. It's unfortunate that the timing didn't work for your wife and daughters. Is it possible that your mother was upset that you didn't invite her, or might be jealous that you have been able to retire? Oh, we got another letter. Dear Abby, I work with a woman who is frequently paralyzed by the possibility that she might do something incorrectly. When writing reports or sending emails, she checks her work again and again, asking multiple people to confirm that she's taking the right approach before proceeding. This is much too slow. It annoys the people that she's badgering. How can I help her relax and understand that there are no negative consequences for being wrong occasionally? We're not brain surgeons. If we make a mistake, it's likely someone will catch it before it comes close to causing a serious problem. Reassuring her that she can be bold only seems to cause more terror. Please help. Signed, Losing Patience. And Abby responds, Dear Losing Patience, it's time to stop coddling your coworker. The way to show her that mistakes are okay is to let her make mistakes. Praise her after she's done something right. Gently correct her occasional blunder. She may be uncomfortable for a while, but everyone will be happier in the end. Don't forget, you can always contact Abigail Van Buren in two ways. You can go to her website, dearabby.com, or write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And now we have time for a comic strip. In the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first frame, there's Mom and Hammy and Zoe. And Hammy says to Mom, "Grounded? Oh, come on, Mom." And she crossed her arms and says, "Well, then I'll let you decide what your punishment will be." So then he thinks, And then in the last frame he says, "You should wash my mouth out with my least favorite flavor of ice cream." And his big sister says, "Hey, if he gets punished, I want to get punished too." And that was Baby Blues. Well, before we leave, let's say happy birthday to some celebrities. Who is celebrating today? Congratulations to actress Robin Strasser. She turns 81 today. The drummer Bill Kreutzmann. He played with the Grateful Dead. He turns 80 today. Singer and actress Thelma Houston turns 80. Director Amy Heckerling turns 72. The singer Eagle Eye Cherry turns 58. The actress Brecken Meyer turns 52. And the drummer Matt Helders with the Arctic Monkeys group, he turns 40. And then there's the YouTube personality James Donaldson. He's also known as Mr. Beast, and he turns 28 today. Congratulations and happy birthday to all of them. Well, I have to say goodbye. Time's just about up. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, May 7th, 2026. I hope you have a great day today, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye-bye.